This episode of the CDR Radio podcast is sponsored by Davie Shipbuilding. One of Canada's oldest and largest shipbuilders, Davie is combining Canadian industrial strength with world-leading international expertise to build the next generation of maritime capability at home. Through projects such as Polarmax, Canada's next generation heavy icebreaker, Davie is leveraging the renowned icebreaker expertise of its Helsinki shipyard while transferring skills, technology, and shipbuilding know-how back to Canada. The result is stronger Canadian shipbuilding capacity, skilled jobs, and a more resilient domestic maritime industry ready to support Canada's Arctic sovereignty and security. Visit davie.ca.
Welcome to Canadian Defence Focus from CDR Radio, produced by Canadian Defence Review Magazine. This series of podcasts features interviews with leaders and experts in the defence industry, as well as reports and profiles on the very latest in defence technology.
So, hey everybody, welcome to CDR Radio. My name is Jyoti Attariwala. I am the senior staff writer for the magazine, and I'm also a naval specialist at the magazine. It is my great pleasure to welcome today as our guest, Vice Admiral Dan Charlebois, who is the brand new commander of the Royal Canadian Navy. Obviously, the Admiral has had a very distinguished and varied career. This is my first time speaking with the Admiral, so I'm really looking forward to this opportunity. Admiral Charlebois, thank you very much for joining me today, sir. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Hey, Jyoti. My pleasure to be with you here this afternoon. Absolutely.
Thank you, sir. First of all, congratulations on your promotion. Congratulations on the appointment as commander of the Royal Canadian Navy. I got to ask you, what advice, if any, did Admiral Topshe share with you during the change of command? And then after that, now you're in the seat. So I got to ask you about your own top priorities for the Royal Canadian Navy.
Hey, thanks, Jyoti. And thanks again for taking the time this afternoon to have a bit of a chat. Listen, Admiral Topshe is somebody I've known for a long time, have a vast amount of respect for it, of course. I've worked with him and for him, actually, over the last 4 years in my two previous jobs as the Deputy Commander of the Navy and before that, Chief of Naval Capability. So I got to know him really well over those 4 years. And when it comes to advice, he provided a few little comments. One, make it your own. He left the Navy in a better place than he found it. And that's not to detract from his predecessor and the work that commander did. I would just suggest that coming out of the pandemic, I think we were all challenged. We were challenged with people. We were challenged with capability. We were challenged with readiness. And because you know Admiral Topshe well over many years, you know his personality, and he's a very forward-leaning leader. And he just took the bull by the horns and, made some aggressive changes on how we deliver people into the Navy, how we deliver more readiness. And so I feel like I've come into a spot where the Navy is in a good place, and I'm optimistic about the future. That all said, he said, you're going to make it your own. You're going to make your own decisions, and don't be afraid to do that. And, I'm not. What are my priorities? Probably not largely different from his. We're still, no surprise to anybody, the Navy still needs more people. We're about 20% short of what our authorized strength is. What I will say is that after a lot of effort by Chief of Military Personnel Command, as well as us in the Navy, I think over the last year, we finally turned a corner on people. We brought in more people than we lost for the first time that I can remember in my career. We've changed fundamentally how we attract and recruit because we needed to. Admiral Topshe was a catalyst for that change. I won't lie to you. We now attract and recruit through our Naval Reserve divisions across the country. We get at portions of our population that doesn't see a lot of the Navy, but we have those NRDs, those Naval Reserve divisions, in key population centers across our country. And that's our access to Canadians that don't know a lot about the Navy. I will continue to focus very heavily on people until all of our ranks are filled. And to be honest, when we get to our authorized strength, which is over 15,000 uniformed sailors, we're going to run right through that wall because it's still not enough. When you look at our future fleet and what we're going to deliver over the next 15 to 20 years, we know we need more sailors. We need more officers. We need more civilians even to support the fleet and the capability that we have and we will have in the future, and to actually be a little bit resilient at the same time.
Yeah, really interesting. I'm thrilled to hear that you have more people joining now, and I hope that trend continues, and I'm confident it will. I'll ask you a little bit later about the Naval Experience Program, which I think is pretty novel, and I've met many of those young individuals, and I cannot think of one that has not been spoken positively about that program. Pretty cool initiative. Yeah. So Canada is in the midst of one of the most significant periods of naval recapitalization in its history. How do you envision the fleet of the future? We are now all aware of the River class destroyer. Submarines are coming. What does a future fleet look like?
You know, that's a question that, one, I get asked a lot at different venues by different people, and something I reflect on a lot too. And I think as a Navy, as an institution, you always need to be examining the Navy that Canada needs. You know, we're so lucky in Canada. We are blessed by our geography. We live in an enormous country. We have more than 240,000 kilometers of coastline, three oceans, and really four coastlines when you consider the St. Lawrence Seaway and the Great Lakes. And when you look at that maritime domain, that real estate, that really demands a fleet mix, a grouping of capabilities of a certain size and a certain makeup. And I think the fleet that we aspire to, the fleet that we are delivering, is the Navy that Canada needs. And you mentioned River-class destroyer. We're currently operating the venerable Halifax-class frigate. That's the ship that I have grown up with and in as a naval officer. My first ship was a Halifax-class. I commanded a Halifax-class. It has served our country extremely well. It has been a workhorse for over three decades, and it will continue to be a workhorse until we take delivery of River-class destroyer in the 2030s. That is 100%. Our future core surface combatant. That is the ship that our country needs to fulfill our core mission, which, if you've listened to our prime minister speak, he is very clear on what that is. He's very clear on our mission, and that is to defend our country and to defend our country's interests at home and abroad. And that's the role of any Navy. It is to defend our country and our interests. And that fleet that we're delivering, River class being the core surface combatant that's replacing Halifax class and the Iroquois class air defense destroyer that we retired, as you well know, more than 10 years ago. That combatant will fulfill both of those roles, the traditional anti-submarine warfare role of the Halifax class, along with the air defense capability that we lost with the Iroquois class. But much more than that, Jody, it delivers long-range precision strike. It delivers autonomous, uncrewed. It's a larger ship. It's got a lot of margin. It's got a lot of capacity for growth in the future, because we're going to deliver this ship over 20 to 25 years. I can guarantee you, and I know I'm not supposed to guarantee things, but over a 25-year build, the 15th ship will look different than the first ship, and it must. We have to evolve. We have to iterate. We have to adapt to what the future is going to look like, and it will undoubtedly look different than it does today. That particular ship will allow us to evolve, and we're going to build it in batches and flights, and we'll alter the design through life to make sure that it still delivers for Canada. And you mentioned future fleet. That, of course, includes joint support ships, a critical capability to sustain operations at sea. Arctic offshore patrol vessels. We've taken delivery. The Navy has now taken delivery of six AOPVs, Arctic Offshore Patrol Vessels. Those ships are at sea a lot, and they are up in our Arctic a lot. We've committed to sending at least two AOPVs to our Arctic every year, and we will hold to that, because part of defending Canada means we need to own our North, and Arctic offshore patrol vessels give the Navy a capability to operate in the north for a really large part of the year.
Yeah, really interesting times, Admiral. I'm excited for the future of the Navy. And Jody,
we're recruiting.
Yeah.
I know a guy.
Well, it's funny that you say that, Admiral. You know, I have thought about that over the years, and every year I get older and I'm like, I should have done it last year. I don't know about that. You know, the body doesn't feel as good as it used to.
I hear you on that one.
Yeah. So look, you also, in one of your previous positions, you served as a Director General Readiness at CJOC. So I'm very keen to hear, how has that experience shaped your approach to balancing ship readiness and availability with the operational demand? Because the demand comes from the government, and so you have to fulfill that demand.
Yeah, that's a great question, Jody. I spent just a little bit less than a year at our Joint Operations Command as a Director General, as you indicated. And I think anytime you get to work in that operational command environment, it gives you a different perspective on the in close. There's a lot of demands on not just the Navy, but the Army and the Air Force and Special Operations Command when it comes to force employment or conducting operations, whether they're overseas or they're domestic operations here in Canada. That year there was eye-opening for me. And I think I was able to bring a bit of a naval perspective to that role, the Navy being the smallest service, sometimes not as well understood. It's not as easy as just taking a ship and plugging a hole in operational schedule and changing the ship's program, because there's second and third order effects in regards to maintenance and readiness and training. And that's not as probably well known across the joint environment. So it's important at our Joint Operations Command that we have senior Navy people in there to add that perspective. At the same time, I got exposed to the demands that we have on us as a CAF when it comes to balancing domestic response and readiness to the demands overseas. You know, you see that with Operation Reassurance and our support to NATO. The Navy, we force generate capabilities in ships and people that Commander CJOC then employs based on government direction around the world. So right now with Op Reassurance, we have three ships that are currently under that flag, two of our maritime coastal defense vessels, which are embarked on a mine countermeasures mission, part of that task group, ready to deliver on that mission should they be needed, as well as a frigate. So we dedicate a lot of resources in support of those missions and in support of CJOC's mandate. But that's the Navy's role. You know, we exist to generate the capabilities that we need to defend our country and to defend our country's interests overseas. And those are typically employed by my very good friend, General Boivin, the Commander CJOC.
Yes. Yeah. We've interviewed him here at CDR as well. Very accomplished leader.
Yes. Yes.
You know, similarly, you also served as Director General of Future Ship Capability, which I think is one of the roles that you alluded to when working closely with Admiral Topshi. And so you oversaw the early stage of the River-class destroyers. What are your priorities to ensure that this new combatant is successfully integrated into fleet operations? Because it's not just, obviously, the most critical thing is, you know, having this ship built and delivered to the Navy, but the work to get there and to have it inducted into the Navy is long before the actual ship arrives.
Yeah, another good question, Jody. And I'd like to say that in my previous capacity, as you rightly pointed out, Director General, Future Ship Capability, which is now evolved into Chief of Naval Capability under the leadership of Rear Admiral Armstrong, I wasn't there necessarily in the early days. Believe it or not, Jody, this has been a project for several years. But what I will say is I was at the helm from the Navy's perspective as we transitioned into actually implementing the project, in that we started to build the first River-class destroyer at Irving Shipyard in Halifax in April of 2025. And when you talk about challenges and priorities – It's often more challenging even. If you think it's challenging to conceive of and design and build a capability, in this case, River-class destroyer, I would suggest that it's equally as challenging to then deliver and implement that capability into the fleet. And when you talk about River-class destroyer, you know, we're looking at by the time it gets delivered in the early 2030s, it's about a 40-year delta from Halifax class to River class. So imagine, if you will, the level of technology and sophistication that we're talking about in River class destroyer comparatively to both Halifax class and Iroquois class. That requires a lot of work on the front end. This is why, Jody, we have already started to train some of our sailors gradually, walking before we run, on the various systems that we're going to deliver with River class destroyer. To me, it's all about early preparation. Not too much too early, but enough on a trajectory that matches the delivery schedule of the ship. So we've started to train sailors on the systems that we'll take delivery of with the ship. We're building in Halifax as well, the land-based test facility. This is a facility that we will integrate all of River class destroyer systems in. It will support the platform through life. It's being built at Heartland Point in Nova Scotia, very near Heartland Point Golf Course, right on the ocean, outward facing, because this facility will have a functional Spy 7 radar. It will have a functional combat management system, and we will learn a ton in that land-based test facility long before we take delivery of our first ship. In fact, that land-based test facility is due to get flashed up, as they say, or start operations in and around 2028. So it is very close. It's being built as we speak. It's progressing very well. If you ever have an opportunity or on the other coast, Jody, I suggest, and I can help you here, you can get out there and have a look. They've made a lot of progress. It's starting to look like a building, and the capability will start to flow into that space over the next 2 years. So to me, it's about preparation. The more we prepare now, the better prepared we're going to be to actually take delivery of the first ship in the early 2030s. And that starts with understanding the capability, and that starts with training our people.
Yeah, absolutely. Admiral, if that's a personal invitation, I'll take you up on it. Absolutely.
Be our pleasure.
Right on. Thank you, sir. So, okay, you know, you used the word challenges in your last response. Let me ask about a potential challenge, at least how I see it, the joint support ships. Are you happy with the progress of the joint support ships?
You know, we use the word challenge a lot. I look at opportunity. You know, joint support ships, like, let's remember, National Shipbuilding Strategy, some very, very intelligent people, much more intelligent than me, about 15 years ago, decided that our country needed a strategy to develop sovereign shipbuilding capability. What I can say, Jody, is in a time of conflict, you do not want to outsource building ships. You want to have that capability within your own borders, and you want to be able to control that capability, because the closer you get to conflict, that type of capability comes in high demand, and then you'll find that there's a queue for customers, and you will likely not be at the front of that line. So 15 years ago, a strategy was developed and investments started, initially with Irving Shipyard in Halifax, C-SPAN in North Vancouver, more recently, Davie and Levy, Quebec, to start to rebuild our shipbuilding industry in our country such that we can build our own surface combatants and support ships again, as we have many times in the past. And the challenge that we found ourselves in was that after building and delivering the Halifax class frigates, we stopped building ships, and that capability atrophied. And what I can tell you about shipbuilding is, one, it is super complex. And if you stop shipbuilding, it's a big struggle to start shipbuilding again, because your workforce, they go and find other opportunities and you lose that expertise and it's hard to get back. So we've grown that back over the last 15 years. And to your point on joint support ships, we started to build Protector, which is the first joint support ship that'll be delivered to the Navy. while we were still rebuilding, investing heavily into C-SPAN. So imagine, if you will, building a first of class. And in shipbuilding parlance, when you're talking about building first of class, it's really a prototype. You are learning a lot of lessons with the intent of flowing those lessons into future ships of that class. As we're doing that, we're building the infrastructure in C-SPAN shipyard to be able to build these ships. So it was a complex situation, made more complex because we were building up the shipyard at the same time we were building the ship. So yes, the ship, the first ship of the class, the Protector, as every first of class has always been, was a challenge. It's late to need. It's cost more money than we had originally planned. But what I will say is this: C-SPAN, much like Irving in Halifax and Davy in Quebec, has hoisted in and taken those lessons learned, and they are applying them to future builds. Not just Navy ships, but also the Coast Guard ships they're building as well. Another person much smarter than me, Jody, decided to slot in two Coast Guard builds in between Joint Support Ship 1 and Joint Support Ship number 2, which is the Future Preserver, to give them enough time to flow the lessons learned from Protector into Preserver. And what I can tell you is Preserver is coming together much better than Protector. It is evident to me, and I've been to the yard many times and have been involved with this program now for over 4 years. So I've seen it with my own eyes. They're building the ship more efficiently. They're building it on a much better schedule, which all equates to a better cost. Because in shipbuilding, schedule is cost. The biggest cost driver to any shipbuilding program is always schedule. The longer it takes, the more it costs. So I am heartened and very optimistic about future shipbuilding in Canada, because I see all of our yards learning and applying lessons. And we're seeing that with Joint Support Ship. We are going to take delivery of Protector next year. Very closely on the heels of Protector, because the build of Preserver is going very well comparatively, the ships are going to come to us on a fairly compressed timeline. So probably late 2027, into 28, we'll take delivery of the second Joint Support Ship, the Preserver. So these capabilities are coming, and they're coming fast. And back to your previous question on priorities, the task that I've given my team is, we will be ready. The Navy will be ready in all respects to take delivery of both of those platforms when they get delivered. As we've waited long for them, we have no excuse to not be ready. So I'm very confident that the Navy is going to be ready to take the ships into service, get them through acceptance trials, and get those ships operationalized. Because I can tell you, Joint Support Ships and ships like that class are in extremely high demand. We need them. Our allies need them. Oceans are massive, especially the Pacific Ocean. There are never enough tankers because they sustain operations. They keep our surface combatants at sea on the front lines. That means they don't have to go back into ports to refuel and get supplies. Support ships keep them where they need to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And it segues perfectly into my next question, which is about the combat support ship Asterix, which is contracted to the Government of Canada and supporting the Royal Canadian Navy. Is there any possibility of the Navy retaining the Asterix, either directly or through NATO, perhaps?
Listen, Jody, any decision to retain the services of Asterix, that's a Government of Canada decision. What I can tell you is Asterix is under contract until the beginning of 2028, and we intend to exercise that contract to the fullest extent. What I would also offer is, over the last now almost 10 years, I think we're in about the ninth year or close to it, Asterix has done everything that we've asked of it to do. And primarily, that is to continue to train our sailors. Our sailors who operate all of those replenishment at sea capabilities and equipment in that class of ship, such that when we take delivery of the Navy's support ship in the Protector and Preserver, we have protected that capability and we've continued to train our folks at sea. And Asterix has delivered on that. And to be honest, I couldn't be more pleased with that service. But at the same time, the Navy needs to pivot and get ready to take delivery of the tankers that are being built for us. Purpose-built Navy tankers with all of the redundancies and capabilities that you would expect to see in a Navy tanker. Asterix has been great, a venerable service, and it's done very well by the Navy and our country. Its contract ends in 2028, at which point we pivot to our tankers, the Joint Support Ships.
Yeah, fair enough, Admiral. But, you know, I take your point that there's just not enough of that capability around the world, let alone in Canada. So, yeah. So, okay, I have to ask you now about submarines. You were present in Halifax for the Prime Minister's announcement of the preferred provider for the Canadian Patrol Submarine Project. What are your reflections from that day, and what's next for the project from a Navy perspective? I understand that the government will go through the negotiations for the contracting and what have you. Is there anything that the Navy specifically needs to do in the interim?
You know, the short answer there, Jody, is a lot. There's a lot to do, which is good. But just back to your original question or statement on, you know, being at the time a very new commander of the Navy. I mean, I'm still new. It's been maybe 6 weeks. At that point, it was, you know, a month. And I was actually on the road. I was down at the International Naval Review down in New York City with many chiefs of Navy from around the world in support of the United States Navy and a large fleet review of which where we had a ship participating. And I got the call that we were going to make an announcement. I did not know what the answer was going to be and what selection was going to be made, but I knew that the announcement was going to happen in Halifax. So I very quickly adjusted my plans to join our prime minister and our minister in Halifax for that announcement. It was a beautiful day in Halifax, bright and sunny. And what a day for the Navy, what a day for our country. The capability that a submarine brings when you look at the defense of our nation, we're talking stealth, we're talking persistence in that it can stay, you know, at sea for fairly long periods of time to control exactly who comes in and goes out of our water space. It provides a level of lethality if it's needed. It is the ultimate deterrent for most maritime threats to our nation. And the only people that were more excited than I was at that event, aside probably from our minister and prime minister, were the many submariners who still serve and sail in Victoria-class submarines, who were also there for that moment, that announcement, which happened on one of our newest Arctic Offshore Patrol vessel, the Robert Hampton Gray. It was a really special moment for our Navy. Up to 12 submarines. It's exactly the capability that our country needs to help defend our nation and specifically key maritime approaches to our nation, including the Arctic. Partnering with Germany and Norway is a very important step in the Navy's recapitalization. And when it comes to what's next, we will work with Germany and Norway and, of course, TKMS, which was the preferred bidder and the company that will build the submarines, on getting to a contract. In the background, the Navy's already starting to look at the training that we need to do because we know we need to grow more submariners. We're going from a fleet of four to up to 12 submarines. We know that apparatus and organization needs to grow, and the team is putting together a very detailed plan on how we grow our submariner group such that we're going to be ready to take delivery of these new submarines starting in the early 2030s. This is all happening much more quickly than many would believe. This has been a very quick procurement. This government makes decisions. They move out quickly. And you'll recall a statement I made earlier on, schedule is the single biggest driver of cost. The faster we move, all informed decisions, all based on research and analysis, the more quickly we move on these decisions, we'll ultimately save on cost. But most importantly to me as the commander of the Navy, it gets capability to my sailors faster, capability that we need.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited for the Canadian Submarine Force, and I personally hope that we get 12. We'll see what happens, but I hope we get 12. Yeah.
You and me both, Jody.
Yeah. It would be good for the submarine force because obviously with their cycles, you know, to get to high readiness and refits and what have you. Yeah, those are the numbers you need.
You know, Jody, it's clear to me that you have studied the Navy because readiness cycles with submarines and ships, it's not as well understood by a lot of people. 12 submarines is a significant amount of submarines, but as you obviously understand, that doesn't mean that all 12 submarines are at sea at the same time and sustained. To sustain 3 to 4 submarines on station, you need at least 12 submarines to account for maintenance, to account for training, some downtime for the crew. All of these things are factors that play into the readiness cycle. But 12 is an appropriate number of submarines to deliver on our mission, which is to defend our country.
Yeah, and another great segue, Admiral, you know, about defending our country and our interests globally. You know, it's the global security environment has changed dramatically. There's an active war in Europe, as we all know, and actually in the Middle East as well. There's more increasing strategic competition in the Indo-Pacific, growing activity in the Arctic. So I'm mentioning all these things to ask you, how is the Royal Canadian Navy adapting the force posture to meet these evolving challenges? Because you have the existing fleet is aging and it takes longer for them to go through their refit cycles, the extended docking work periods, what have you. But the demand signal is probably higher than it has been in many, many years.
Yeah, Jody, it's a wicked problem and it's been a wicked problem for some time. And, you know, as you rightly pointed out, the world is currently a pretty sporty place, and I don't see that changing in the near term. There's active conflicts in a variety of regions of the world. Some of those regions we operate in as a Navy and as Canadian Armed Forces. And anything that happens today, we manage with what we have today. You know, I talked about being optimistic about our future. We are undergoing a very significant recapitalization. We have projects that are delivering now, and we'll have submarines and new destroyers in the 2030s, but that's not today. Today, we respond with what we have, and from a Navy's perspective, that's the Halifax-class frigate, of which we have 12. Availability of that platform is a challenge. I mean, there's no secret with that. They're 30-plus years old. They require more maintenance. Work periods take longer, but it's really important, notwithstanding the operational demands, that we continue to give a platform that our sailors will operate the right amount of maintenance and repair to ensure that, one, it's safe and seaworthy. And I can tell you that we are investing heavily in the seaworthiness of the Halifax class to keep it capable and safe at sea. But more than that, Jody, we are investing in capability in Halifax class as well. Not delivering River class until the 2030s. That's another 10, 15 years of operating Halifax class. The absolute critical bridge to deliver River class is maintaining Halifax class. It keeps our operators trained and savvy on how to fight such that we have the right people to transition into River class. So we're investing in Halifax class, in particular in anti-submarine warfare. That's been a core capability of our Navy dating back to the Second World War. It's been an area of expertise, and we're doubling down on that with Halifax class. So we are making investments in that platform such that it remains a credible capability, a credible deterrent in defense of our country, but also contributing to operations overseas. That doesn't solve the availability problem. It's still an older ship, but we have phenomenal shipyards on both coasts, in C-SPAN and Irving, who maintain and support Halifax class, Davie in Lévis, Quebec, they also support the class. And moreover, our fleet maintenance facilities, which you'd be familiar with on our coasts, that's over 2,000 highly trained civilians who maintain Halifax class, keep it credible, keep it safe, and keep it relevant. And we're going to continue to do that to get as many of those ships to sea, to maintain a strong operational posture, and moreover, to continue to force generate and personnel generate, the sailors that we need to crew the future fleet. But in a conflict, you participate with what you have. And on the combatant side, for us, that's Halifax class. But we are investing in that class to keep it relevant and keep it credible and keep it safe.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, it has to be there. It's the bridge to the future for sure. So, Admiral, my final question to you is, I think it's right to finish on talking about the people. We spoke briefly or referenced the Naval Experience Program. You know, what should Canadians understand about the work that the sailors of the Royal Canadian Navy are doing, and why continued investment in maritime capability is essential for Canada?
Another great question, Jody. Listen, I don't think I'm alone, and I'll make a statement here. The prosperity of most any nation, especially those that are surrounded by three oceans, the prosperity of any nation surrounded by water starts with a secure maritime frontier. Being able to protect and surveil our key maritime approaches is paramount to our country's economic and security prosperity for future generations. That demands a Navy of a certain size and composition. But moreover, it's the people that you have in those platforms that are the true difference maker. My perspective is our people, our sailors, our officers, our civilians, for that matter, those are our most important assets, more important than any capability we'll ever deliver. Our sailors, based on their training, based on their dedication, let's not forget, this is a choice. This is a volunteer service. If you're going to serve in the Navy, you've made that choice. That, to me, already demonstrates a high level of dedication. And, you know, when you talk about a volunteer service of highly trained folks, you know, that to me is a decisive factor when it comes to delivering on operations. These are people who want to be there. They want to serve their country. They want to defend their country if needed. And that's why people, to me, will always be our number one priority, and they'll always be our number one strength. It's hard to understand what the Navy does unless you talk to a sailor. My recommendation to anybody is to go to a Naval Reserve Division if you live in the middle of Canada. If you live on a coast, you can see some of the Navy. The Navy is an experience. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I've been in the Navy for 34 years. I've visited 70 countries with the Navy and spent over 1,500 days at sea. To gain that appreciation, you almost have to do it. The next best thing is to talk to a sailor. The Naval Experience Program, again, this has been now a few years that we've been running the program, all designed to present another option or another vehicle to see the Navy and join the Navy. No strings attached. You come in, you do basic training. We show you all sorts of different opportunity. We send you on courses. We give you experience in different platforms. We expose you to the Navy, which gives a person a choice. It also gives the Navy a choice. Are they right for the Navy? Is the Navy right for them? It's a two-way conversation. But what I will tell you is we've seen a great uptake through the Naval Experience Program for folks joining CAF. Not always the Navy. Not everybody. The Navy is not for everybody. It is a challenging and demanding profession. And I can say that with great authority, having done it for 34 years. It's not for everybody. But the program has brought different people into the CAF that might not have joined. So we've seen some uptake in the Navy, which is great, but those who haven't joined the Navy, some have joined the Air Force, some have joined the Army, but the number is 83% success rate of folks actually signing a contract and joining the Canadian Armed Forces through that program. And to me, that's a big success.
It is a big success. I think those are very admirable numbers. And a novel program, and I'm glad it's reaping some benefits and some rewards for the Canadian Armed Forces, and hopefully more the Navy, but writ large, it's a good
program. I like that, Jody. I like
right.
It.
Vice Admiral Dan Charlebois, thank you so much, sir, for taking the time to speak with me. It's been a great pleasure. I've really enjoyed this chat, and I look forward to seeing how the next few years pan out under your command. It'll be fun, interesting times.
Absolutely, Jody. Real pleasure. Pleasure was mine. And we'll look forward to connecting at some point in the future, face to face, whether it's a sit down over a table or we get you into Dockyard and do a little walk around. We'll figure something out.
That, my friends, was Vice Admiral Dan Charlebois, the new commander of the Royal Canadian Navy. Thanks, everybody, for watching, and hope you'll join us for another episode. Take care.
Tune in next time for another Canadian Defense Focus podcast from CDR Radio.